Good morning. I assume you hear me. Good morning. I'm really pleased to welcome you all here. My name is Rosie Goldstein. I'm the Vice Principal of Research and International Relations here at McGill. And it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to the 2012 BD Memorial Lecture, taking place once again during McGill's homecoming weekend. So to many of you I know are returning alumni, a special welcome, and I hope you're enjoying a beautiful Montreal weekend and a wonderful homecoming weekend. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à la conférence commémorative BD, un événement annuel très cher à l'Université McGill. The BD Memorial Lecture dates back to 1952, when McGill received a $100,000 gift from Dr. Henry Beattie. He gave this generous donation to establish a public lecture series in honor of his brother, Sir Edward Beattie, who was president of the Canadian Pacific Railway at that time. McGill was the logical home for this initiative. Sir Edward had served McGill both as chancellor and chair of the Board of Governors together for over two decades, 1920 to 1943. The Beattie family has made a lasting impact at McGill, not only these lectures. They also established a series of student scholarships that are awarded in the name of Sir Edward as well. Moreover, his former home, known today as Beattie Hall, houses the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. From the beginning, this Beattie Memorial Lecture Series has intended to bring top thinkers, innovators, and leaders to the McGill campus in the service of advancing scholarship, both at McGill and in the broader Montreal community. Topics over the last few years have covered sustainability, neuroscience, microlending. Last year, 2011, we had the world-renowned pianist Alfred Brendel receive an honorary degree from McGill before delivering his talk. Today, I'm proud to introduce Professor Carrie Kernier. He's the Canada Research Chair, CRC Chair in Physical Activity and Cancer. He joins this highly esteemed group of Beattie Memorial Lecturers. In a few minutes, he will tell us how important the physical exercise and activity is in the prevention of cancer and also in its treatment and healing qualities for survivors of the disease. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Faculty of Education, especially the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education, for inviting Dr. Kernier. As you may have heard, the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. From its month-long course in the summer in 1912, the department has gone from trailblazer to research leader. The unit has grown, adapted, and evolved into a highly interdisciplinary and successful group. They excel in both the traditional aspects of the field and in more recent areas of research, such as aging, obesity, and sports psychology. In my opinion, the department is a prime example of McGill's dedication to cutting-edge collaborative research and problem-solving. So it's my pleasure to call upon our current chancellor. As I mentioned, Sir Edward Beattie was the chancellor at McGill University as well, so it's fitting that I call upon Chancellor Arnold Steinberg to welcome our esteemed guest, Chancellor Steinberg.
Thank you, Rosie. Good morning. Bonjour à tous. It's my pleasure and privilege to introduce the 2012 Beattie Memorial Lecturer. As Rosie has indicated, Carrie Kernier is the Canada Research Chair in Physical Activity and Cancer, as well as a professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Recreation at the University of Alberta. He is also Director of the University of Alberta's Behavioral Medicine Laboratory and Fitness Center. Professor Kernier is widely acknowledged as a world leader in investigating the effects of physical activity on cancer, including its impact on primary prevention, coping with treatments, recovery, secondary prevention, and survival. Not only is his research helping patients and clinicians achieve better outcomes during and following cancer treatment, but it is also fundamentally transforming cancer treatment by positioning physical activity alongside chemotherapy and radiation as part of standard care. Notably, he is co-leading an innovative study called the Colon Health and Lifelong Exercise Change Trial, or CHALLENGE. The initiative is designed to determine the effects of exercise on nearly 1,000 colon cancer survivors across Canada and Australia. He is also team co-leader for the Alberta Moving Beyond Breast Cancer, or AMBER, cohort study, which is exploring the links between physical activity, health-related fitness, and disease outcomes in 1,500 Alberta breast cancer survivors. Finally, he co-authored both the American Cancer Society's Physical Activity and Nutrition Guidelines and the American College of Sports Medicine's Exercise Guidelines for Cancer Survivors. Educated at the University of Western Ontario and the University of Illinois, Professor Kernier has received numerous awards over the course of his distinguished career. These include the Rain Visiting Professorship at the University of Western Australia, the Killam Annual Professorship at his home university, and the Investigator Award from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. Please join me in welcoming Professor Cary Kernier.
Sorry, I'm just going to have to get this presentation up here. I'm not sure what happened on it. There we go. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chancellor Steinberg, for that very kind and generous introduction. And thanks to Dr. Rose Goldstein and the Beattie Memorial Lecture Selection Committee for selecting me for this very prestigious award. I can assure you that people in kinesiology are not used to receiving such prestigious awards. There is no Nobel Prize in kinesiology for which we try to achieve. So we're a field that in some ways flies under the radar in terms of the big science and the big newsworthy types of things that happen. So it's a real honor to receive this award for myself, but also on behalf of the field of kinesiology. And also at a time when McGill is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education. So true leaders and true pioneers in developing this whole field of kinesiology. So I'm going to talk about the role of exercise in cancer survivors. And for those of you who will be attending the banquet tonight in physical education and kinesiology, you'll see, wow, has this field changed over the last 100 years. Compared to what we started out doing in the whole field of kinesiology and physical education. And I think my research represents some of that innovation and some of that change and thinking about exercise in ways we haven't thought about it before. So you'll see during my talk that we really haven't thought about the role of exercise in treatment for cancer patients or getting through cancer. And so I want to tell you a little bit about the rationale for this research, what some of the exciting evidence is about the role of exercise for cancer survivors, and then also give you some of the practical guidelines for what you can do if you've been diagnosed with cancer or someone you love has been diagnosed with cancer. So we call it a field in motion. Let me start off with these statistics. I suspect all of you either know somebody or many of you will have had cancer yourself. It's a disease that really affects all of us. There's over 100 different types of cancer. And in Canada, there's 186,000 diagnoses every year and about 75,000 deaths from cancer every year. Even though it's over 100 different types of cancer, four of them make up over 50% of all cancers diagnosed: prostate, lung, colorectal, and breast. So if there's four cancers you should worry about, those are the four that make up most of the cancer diagnosis, and in fact, over 50% of all cancer deaths as well. Amazingly, in your lifetime, for men, 45% will be diagnosed with cancer at some point. So almost half of men at some point in their life will be diagnosed with cancer. For women, it's about 40%. So you've got a very large chance of going through this either yourself or one of the members of your family. It does tend to be an older person's disease. 88% of cases are diagnosed in people over age 50, but it certainly strikes younger people as well. Of course, you all know about the tragic cases of childhood cancer, and certainly there are diagnoses in young adults. But overall, it's a disease that increases dramatically as we age. The good news is the survival rate has improved. Earlier diagnosis, better treatments, 62% five-year relative survival rate across all the different cancers. And that varies by different cancer types and different cancer stages. So if you put this all together, we have an estimate of about 1 million cancer survivors in Canada. So it's a growing population, and in one sense, that's good. People are living longer, but that means you have to deal with the issues of the cancer diagnosis and other treatment-related complications. So what are the issues that cancer survivors face? Treatments are complex and difficult. So for many cancer patients, that includes surgery, it includes chemotherapy, which can be 4 months, 6 months, or longer, radiation therapy, the new hormone therapies, and biologic therapies. And these can be given the same treatments to the same person. So one single person can have surgery, followed by chemotherapy, followed by radiation therapy, and then perhaps onto hormone therapies or biologic therapies. And these treatments can last not just many months, but many years. So in some ways, we think of cancer as a chronic disease, where it's just managed on a long term over a long period of time. So you can imagine these treatments, which are very effective in treating cancer, can also cause many different side effects. Lots of acute side effects going through treatment, things like nausea and vomiting, fatigue, peripheral neuropathy, pain, menopausal symptoms, insomnia, depression. So a whole host of side effects that we know cancer patients experience going through these treatments. What we've learned more recently is a lot of these side effects don't necessarily stop when the treatment stops. We used to think that these are acute side effects. As soon as you stop treatment, these things will go away. And we find that there's now chronic effects that last even after treatments are done. And we also have what we call late effects or late appearing effects. So these are effects that aren't present at the time of treatment, but many years after cancer diagnosis, these types of things can happen. And certainly the most concerning is a recurrence of the cancer, but also cancer patients are at higher risk of heart disease, osteoporosis, liver disease, and other effects as well, because these treatments can affect the whole body. So to sum up the rationale for my research program, and it's really the rationale for intervening with cancer patients for any intervention, this is what the Canadian Cancer Society notes in its cancer statistics. A large number of Canadians live with the effects of cancer, require repeated active treatment, and have a continuing need for cancer care resources and supportive services. And what this means is cancer patients need help to cope with the disease, to get through the treatments, and to recover after the treatments. My whole research program focuses on the role of exercise. It's kind of an innovative new way of trying to help patients. There are, of course, many other things that are being done that are very helpful and very effective in improving treatments. But research and exercise is very recent. So why might that be? I'm sure you're all sitting there thinking, well, exercise is good. We know it's good for cardiac rehabilitation. We know it helps diabetics manage insulin and so on. So why wouldn't researchers have been on this much earlier than now? So here's a few reasons I think that it's not obvious that exercise might be beneficial or helpful. Treatments, as I mentioned, are very difficult, but they were even more difficult 10, 20 years ago. Very severe side effects that were very difficult to manage. There weren't a lot of the supportive care drugs. So patients were sick during these treatments. So it's natural that doctors recommended rest. Take it easy, don't do too much while you're getting through these difficult treatments. And I'm sure patients were very receptive to that type of advice when you're not feeling well. As well, 20 years ago, survival rates were shorter. Many patients did not live very long with cancer, so the priority of exercise or quality of life for these types of issues wasn't there. The focus was on survival and the other issues that might arise at the end of life. And because these survival rates were shorter as well, we didn't even know about long-term complications. Right? It's only recently where we have people surviving 20, 30, 40 years after cancer, And largely from the childhood cancer studies where they follow these people now for 20, 30, 40 years, we begin to see there are these long-term complications and problems. So it's good that people are living longer from the cancer, but it's exposing some of these longer-term side effects that we weren't previously aware about. And quality of life was not really considered a priority, even when I started my research 20 years ago. The idea was if the intervention's not really treating the tumor, you don't have a lot to offer cancer care. But over the last 10 and 20 years, quality of life has become a very important issue, both to the oncologists, the patients, and the whole cancer care community. So what that means is interventions that improve quality of life are also now valued by the cancer care community. And of course, this opens up a role for exercise much more than would have previously been noted. There were some concerns about immunosuppression. Some of you may know that very elite athletes, marathon runners and so on, high intensity exercise for long periods of time can suppress the immune system. And so given that patients are going through these difficult treatments that were immunosuppressive themselves, oncologists had some concerns about risks of infections and so on. But those things now have all changed to some extent and opened the door for research on exercise. So what are some of the important questions from an exercise perspective? And these are questions that patients would have and the oncologists would have in recommending exercise. The first, I think, and most important one, is it really safe to exercise during chemotherapy? Chemotherapy can result in a lot of side effects and problems, and is it really safe to do that? And perhaps the next most important question, will exercise interfere with my ability to complete chemotherapy treatments? Probably the number one concern of any cancer patient is making sure you get all the treatments from the biomedical group that you can get, because that's what's going to result in the cure to cancer. And you don't want to do anything that's going to interfere with your ability to complete those treatments or your ability to respond to those treatments. And then can exercise help manage treatment side effects? All these problems that I have while I'm going through treatment, would they be made worse by exercise or would they really be benefited from exercise? And perhaps the million-dollar question, the holy grail question in my field would be, can exercise lower the risk of cancer recurrence and improve survival? So essentially, can exercise be another cancer treatment? And that's probably one of the most important questions that patients have. Is there anything I can do for myself after completing my treatments that will actually help me in the fight against cancer? And I'll provide some data on all these issues here. And then, of course, hopefully at the end of the presentation, you'll be saying what exercise program is best to get these types of benefits. So let me give you some early research that we did just to kind of set the stage. This is some simple survey data we did with cancer survivors. In this case, it's breast cancer survivors. And we asked them just to recall, how much exercise were you doing before you were diagnosed with breast cancer? How much exercise did you do during treatment, which is mostly chemotherapy, radiation therapy? And how much exercise are you doing now? And we can break it up into light, moderate, and vigorous intense. And you can see what happens. This is the moderate intensity, so the healthy types of exercise, and this is the vigorous type of exercise, and this is their frequency per week. So what you can see is large numbers of patients are telling us that their exercise levels decline dramatically during treatment. That's the natural response. You get diagnosed, you go on to treatment, exercise is not going to be a priority, you don't feel well, you're not going to exercise. There's some recovery after treatments, but it's not back to pre-diagnosis levels. So some indication that cancer and its treatments can have kind of a permanent negative impact on leading a healthy lifestyle. Same data with colorectal cancer survivors, asking them what they do. Again, significant declines. Not a whole lot of vigorous intensity exercise going on to begin with, but certainly very difficult to do that exercise. What this means is it's not obvious to patients that they should be exercising during treatments. And it's not obvious to the oncologist that they should be recommending exercise during treatments. And the last slide here, another common cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And here we're focusing on the minutes per week of exercise. A little bit harder to see maybe there with the red line, but this is the moderate plus vigorous combined. Dramatic decline. So this is what patients do naturally when they get diagnosed with cancer and they go through treatment. So you can see, if we don't do any interventions to support them or help them, this will be the natural history of exercise. And that's concerning enough, but even more concerning is it doesn't even get back to pre-diagnosed level. So it's difficult to recover after these treatments. So let me walk you through a few studies. We call them randomized controlled trials. These are studies where we assign patients to different groups of exercise or usual care and try and tease out what are the possible outcomes of exercise. This trial we call the START trial, and it was the first study comparing aerobic exercise, so endurance exercise like walking, cyclergometer, and so on, to weight training, because both of these early on showed some potential benefits. So we had one group that did a weight training program, one group that did a kind of walking cyclergometer exercise program, and then one group UC we call usual care. They just kind of went on, and based on the previous slides, you know what usual care is, which is not exercising, not doing anything. This was 242 breast cancer patients on chemotherapy. So it was really one of the first trials to tie the exercise intervention completely to the chemotherapy protocol and try and answer the question, if you're diagnosed with breast cancer, should you be exercising while you're on chemotherapy? We collaborated with Ottawa Regional Cancer Center, Roanne Siegel there, and also Don McKenzie in Vancouver. And this was funded by the Canadian Breast Cancer Research Alliance. So one of the novel findings we found right away is what the aerobic exercise did in terms of cardiovascular fitness or exercise capacity was prevent decline. So you can see these chemotherapy treatments are having a negative impact on patients' exercise capacity. It declines over the course of treatment, and they don't function as well physically. And what the aerobic exercise intervention was able to do was to prevent that decline in their fitness. In terms of muscular strength, as you would expect, the weight training group did better. So they increased strength over the course of the intervention compared to the group that did endurance exercise or the group that did no exercise. And we even have some differences by the types of treatments. And this is where things start to get complex. Chemotherapy is not a single treatment. There's 100 different types of chemotherapies that are used, and they're used in combinations of 2 and 3 drugs. So this is showing you that patients that received certain treatments like taxanes didn't benefit as much from the exercise as patients that were on another group of chemotherapies that don't have taxanes in them. So this tells us that there's something about certain types of chemotherapy that might be affecting the body's ability to respond to exercise. Changes in lean body mass. Add a kilogram of muscle in the intervention group that received weight training, so building muscle over the course of chemotherapy, something we didn't think could be done, and changes in body fat. The body fat finding is particularly important. So you can see, again, the usual care group is increasing its percentage body fat. They're becoming fatter over the course of chemotherapy. Why is that bad? Well, we know from epidemiological evidence that obesity in breast cancer patients at the time of diagnosis and weight gain over the course of chemotherapy is a bad prognostic factor for recurrence and survival, meaning patients who gain weight are more likely to have a recurrence and have a shorter survival. So this has spawned a lot of interest, not just in exercise interventions for breast cancer patients, but in weight loss interventions as well, with the idea that that might influence recurrence and survival. Perhaps the most exciting finding and really the most provocative finding that challenged conventional wisdom, I think, from this study was the chemotherapy that they received. So this RDI variable is a variable we call relative dose intensity. And the goal of these chemotherapy treatments is to get all the drugs you're supposed to get and to get them on time. So, for example, in breast cancer, typically you might get 2 or 3 drugs and you'll get them every 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks later, you'll go back in for another chemotherapy infusion. So what happens is oncologists sometimes have to reduce the dose of the drugs, or they have to delay the treatments for a week or longer to allow the bone marrow to recover. And the more they have to do that, the more problematic that is, because now you're not getting the full dose of drugs that can cure the cancer. So we wanted to make sure that exercise was not interfering with the ability of these breast cancer patients to get their chemotherapy treatments. And much to our surprise, we actually found that the weight training group completed more of their chemotherapy treatments than the usual care group. They completed about 90% of the treatments compared to about 84% of the treatments completed by the usual care group. So not only is exercise not interfering with their ability to complete treatments, it seems to be actually helping them complete their drugs on time and at full dose. And even the aerobic exercise group did a little bit better than the usual care group. So that was very reassuring in terms of the safety issue. So we followed up this trial with one we called the Combined Aerobic and Resistance Exercise Trial. So if aerobic exercise is good and weight training is good, maybe combining them might be good. Although we definitely had concerns that this might be too much exercise. How much exercise can you really do when you're on chemotherapy, you're sick, and you're not feeling well? So it wasn't obvious to us that sort of more exercise would necessarily be better. But that was the question we wanted to look at. And so really this trial focused on different types and doses of exercise, answering the question what type of exercise might be best and how much might be best. And we worked with the same groups in Vancouver and Ottawa that we worked with on the START trial. And in this trial, we included 301 breast cancer patients, so about 100 in each of these three groups that we designed. So just to sort of show you the design of the study, we called this a standard aerobic exercise group, so this is aerobic exercise. They came in to our fitness center three times per week and did about 30 minutes of aerobic exercise, so similar to what we did in the START trial. Then we had a group come in and do 30 minutes of aerobic exercise, but we also had 30 minutes of weight training added to this group. And of course, one of the dilemmas with just comparing these two groups is it's not clear whether doing more exercise is better or really doing weight training is better, that you should be adding weight training to this exercise protocol. So we added a third group that we called the high volume group. So this group attempted to do 60 minutes of aerobic exercise three times per week. So a very high amount of aerobic exercise, and it was moderate to vigorous intensity. So many of them were jogging, cycle ergometer, and so on. So it was fairly intense exercise at a higher volume. But this would help us tease out the question of whether more exercise is better or whether a certain type of exercise is better. I forgot to mention this in the START trial, but one of the positive findings is adherence is quite good. These breast cancer patients do incredibly well at sticking with these particular exercise programs. Now, adherence was a little bit better in the standard amount of exercise group compared to the high group or the combined group. But still, overall, the adherence was good, well over 70% in all three groups. And in terms of the individual sessions, they were able to achieve a much higher duration of exercise. So the high group did about 48 minutes of exercise on average compared to the standard group, and the cone group, of course, did the 30 minutes of aerobic exercise. So what did we find? Well, a little bit to our surprise, this is a measure here about patients' reports of their physical health, how well they're functioning physically as they go through chemotherapy treatments. So the first thing you can see is decline. We already knew that. As you go through chemotherapy, your physical health takes a beating. But what we found is that the high exercise group prevented the decline better than the combined or the standard amount of exercise. So it looks like this higher volume of aerobic exercise was not only feasible, but beneficial in terms of improving the physical health as they go through treatment. We found this pattern for other things we measured too. Reports of bodily pain. How much pain are you experiencing as you go through treatment? Again, to our surprise, the groups that did the higher amount of aerobic exercise experienced less pain, not more pain. Hormonal symptoms. We know these chemotherapy treatments can induce ovarian failure. And about a third of breast cancer patients are premenopausal at the time of the diagnosis, and then when they go on to chemotherapy, these treatments can put them into ovarian failure. So they experience all sorts of menopausal symptoms, and these can be very distressing to patients, things like hot flashes and night sweats and so on. Well, we had good news here. This is the first time this has been looked at in any exercise study, and both the high group and the cone group perform better than the standard group. So again, these symptoms are accumulating as you go over the course of chemotherapy, but they are accumulating less for the group that does more exercise. And this is before chemo. This is one-third of the way through chemo, two-thirds of the way through chemo, and then after chemo. So we track them all the way across the chemotherapy treatments. And these last anywhere from 12 to 18 weeks of treatment. And we don't have a no exercise group, and we suspect their symptoms would be even worse, because we know from previous studies that this standard amount of exercise is good by itself. So these studies are showing that even more exercise is better. And fatigue was not different between the groups, but it did favor the higher groups. And this was important, because if there's one sort of symptom you'd be concerned about with this high volume, high intensity exercise, it would be making patients too fatigued while they're going through these treatments. But we didn't see anything that suggested that higher amounts of exercise were inducing more fatigue than the lower amounts of exercise. And once again, we tracked all the chemotherapy treatments and tracked the relative dose intensity. And in this trial, we found no differences among the groups. So all three groups received over 90% of their planned chemotherapy. And this is another, I think, important finding. So even this higher dose of aerobic exercise, even doing combined weight training and aerobic exercise, does not interfere with patients' ability to complete their chemotherapy treatments. The last trial I'll give you some results on, and this is to move outside of breast cancer. And certainly the vast majority of research in the exercise and cancer field has been in breast cancer patients. So this is a study we did in lymphoma patients. We called it the Healthy Exercise for Lymphoma Patients Trial. And we looked at an aerobic exercise intervention, compared it to sort of usual care, which is no exercise. And this was in 122 lymphoma patients. One of the interesting things with this study is we had patients who were both on chemotherapy and off treatments. So we were able to directly compare how patients on chemotherapy responded to exercise to patients who were not on treatment at the time. 12 weeks of supervised exercise training, and again, a 78% exercise adherence. So overall, the patients were able to tolerate the exercise and were motivated to do it. And we looked at a bunch of different outcomes, fitness, quality of life, symptoms, and so on. So I'll give you here, and these figures will kind of be the results overall, and then we break them down to whether the patients were on chemotherapy or off treatments. And about half the patients were on chemotherapy and half the patients were off treatment. Overall, as you might expect, a very big effect on aerobic fitness. The important finding here is the magnitude of the effect, this 20% improvement in fitness, was not different. Whether they were on chemo or off, the difference between the groups is the same. How they get that effect is a little bit different. So just like in our previous breast cancer trial, you can see patients on chemotherapy, their fitness actually declines while they go through chemotherapy. Where when you're not on treatment, you kind of get the standard improvements in aerobic fitness that you might expect. On quality of life, a very important finding, similar findings. Whether you're on chemotherapy or off treatment, lymphoma patients had significant improvements in their quality of life over the course of this 12-week exercise program. Patients on treatment were actually preventing some decline. Same with fatigue, another very important outcome we talked about. And this is perhaps one of the more paradoxical findings for patients and oncologists. If you exercise during chemotherapy, you report less fatigue. If you rest and take it easy, you end up reporting more fatigue at the end of the chemotherapy. Sleep quality. This is another important issue. Insomnia is a significant side effect of these treatments, and we found that, at least for patients on chemotherapy, they benefited. So the lower scores mean benefit. So this is telling us that the aerobic exercise group slept better during chemotherapy than the group that didn't do exercise. So even managing a symptom like sleep dysfunction has there's a potential role for exercise. And if we just break them into whether they were good sleepers or bad sleepers, all of the benefit, of course, is in bad sleepers. So people who told us they were sleeping fine at the beginning of the intervention, well, we wouldn't expect exercise to help them sleep better. But the patients that told us that their sleep was not very good had a dramatic benefit to their sleep quality over the course of the exercise intervention. And in this study, we tracked just the number of cycles they completed for chemotherapy. And typically in lymphoma patients, there's some range of cycles they might give, like 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy. So we could calculate the percentage of the minimum they received and the percentage of the maximum. No difference here, but again, the pattern favoring the exercise group. So if anything, the exercise group completes more cycles of their chemotherapy than the group not doing the exercise, although this, as I said, was not a significant difference. Equally exciting and of great potential interest is we were able to track the treatment response of patients when they were in this trial. So what happens in lymphoma? There's usually existing disease. Patients show up. They get their chemotherapy, and afterwards, based on various scans and other tests, patients are rated as either having stable disease, the cancer's not grown, but it's also not shrunk. They're rated as having a partial response to the chemotherapy, meaning the tumors have shrunk, some of them have gone away, and there's a meaningful reduction in the amount of cancer. Or they have what's called a complete response, meaning there's no evidence of cancer left in the body after the treatments. So we were able to get that data in this trial. And what you can see here is, in the exercise group, about 45% of patients were judged to have a complete response to their chemotherapy. In the usual care group, only about 30% of patients had a complete response to chemotherapy. So kind of a suggestion that not only does exercise help you get through the treatments, it might even facilitate a better response to the chemotherapy treatments. And again, this is a kind of a pilot or preliminary finding, but it's very exciting and very suggestive of a potential treatment benefit for patients who exercise while getting chemotherapy. So the Holy Grail question, exercise and cancer survival. Well, we've got lots of what we call observational data. No definitive data at this time, but we have probably 10 to 12 studies that have looked at breast cancer patients. And I'll go over these data in a moment. But the basic idea is you just follow patients over time once they're diagnosed, ask them how much exercise they're doing at various time points, and then they follow them up for recurrence and for death from cancer. And what all these studies are showing in breast cancer, but based on these data here, is that the cancer patients who report the highest amount of exercise compared to those who are not exercising have a much lower risk of death from breast cancer. And it's about a 50% lower risk. Most active patients, 50% lower risk of dying from breast cancer than the patients who are least active when they follow them up over time. Similar data we have in colorectal cancer and even some in ovarian cancer, prostate cancer as well. And again, from these data, what you can see is the patients that are more active, when you follow them over time, they have lower rates of dying from colorectal cancer and lower rates of death from all causes. And in several of these studies, there's even lower rates of recurrence of the disease. So this is preliminary evidence, but it's very exciting in suggesting that perhaps if you exercise after your diagnosis, there may be a lower risk of recurrence of the disease and longer survival. All observational data. So we have initiated this study here that was talked about earlier called the Challenge Trial. And this trial is significant because it's the first randomized controlled trial, which is considered the gold standard evidence of looking at causation between two variables. Looking at physical activity intervention and disease recurrence in colon cancer survivors. It's a 3-year physical activity intervention. And that's how long we think it would take to try and change disease outcomes. You can improve quality of life in a shorter term. You can improve fitness in a shorter term. But if you're trying to change the course of disease with lifestyle interventions, you typically need a much longer intervention. So we're going to intervene for 3 years, and we compare a physical activity intervention to standard health education materials. And as I said, it's the first study with disease-free survival as the outcome in the study. 962 patients were hoping to accrue to this trial, and it's being run both in Canada through the National Cancer Institute of Canada Clinical Trials Group and also in Australia as well. So we're on our way. We've launched the study a couple years ago, and we're making great progress in this study. And perhaps some years down the road, we'll have some results for you to try and definitively answer that question of whether or not what you choose to do in terms of exercise can influence disease outcomes. So to summarize this research, I think it's fair to say exercise is safe during chemotherapy. Exercise does not interfere with chemotherapy treatments, may actually help with them. It improves outcomes like physical functioning, fatigue, sleep quality, depression, and so on, and may even lower the risk of cancer recurrence and improve survival in breast and colon cancer survivors. So what about the exercise guidelines for cancer survivors? Let me just take a few minutes and give you kind of where we're at in terms of these guidelines. So these are the guidelines published by the American College of Sports Medicine, which is kind of the professional body for people in the exercise science area. And these were published in 2010, the first ever guidelines for this organization on exercise in cancer survivors. And then the American Cancer Society has now published guidelines for nutrition and physical activity for cancer survivors. And both these guidelines get at the same sorts of issues that I'll summarize for you. First of all, a few exercise and cancer principles. A cancer diagnosis, oddly enough, may be a good time to start an exercise program. What we find is, at that time, many patients are quite interested in finding out, is it time to make a change in my life? Is there something I should be doing different now that I've been diagnosed with cancer? So it can be a bit of a wake-up call and a time to rethink about lifestyle issues. And so we find certainly a subset of cancer patients are quite interested and motivated, even at that early diagnosis phase and going through treatments. However, waiting till after treatments is also a good idea if treatments are very difficult. We've done surveys with thousands of cancer survivors asking them when they would like to start exercise. And we find about half of them say, I would like to start after I'm done treatments. And presumably those are the half where the treatments are very difficult and very adverse side effects. So again, either one's appropriate depending on how you're feeling and getting through treatments. What you don't want to do is be part of that group that has the permanent negative impact of treatments on exercise and not start even after treatments are over. The cancer treatments themselves and the side effects can affect all aspects of the exercise prescription. So it's really about coming up with a prescription that's right for you, depending on the types of side effects you're experiencing. And speaking with your oncologist is certainly recommended if you are considering getting very active. General exercise principles that we give to all people. Avoid inactivity. There is some data coming out that I'm not getting into today in my talk that sedentary behavior is bad. I know this is very unfortunate. You're all sitting down right now thinking of this. But the amount of time you spend sitting is a negative factor on various health outcomes, potentially even cancer. So just standing up and moving around can have some benefits. We also know that some exercise is better than none, and more exercise is better. So generally, there's a dose-response relationship. The more exercise you do, the more benefits you get. But even at very low levels, there can be benefits. Start easy, progress slowly, and exercise is a long-term commitment. You want to develop an exercise program that you're going to do for the rest of your life, not one that you can sort of endure over the next 6 weeks. But think about what's feasible for you to do over the rest of your life. Aerobic and strength exercise are recommended in all these guidelines. They are complementary. They do benefit in different ways. And we don't see any evidence that one specific type of aerobic exercise is better. You know, to say, well, cycle ergometer is better than swimming or it's better than jogging or this type of thing. So you really have to think about acute and chronic treatment side effects. And that can help you select what type of exercise you might want to do. Certainly, we recommend selecting an activity you enjoy. Variety is also a great way of getting exercise. If you don't have a preference, walking is the most common. And again, when we survey thousands of cancer survivors, just like the general public, they will tell us walking is the most preferred exercise. And brisk walking can get many of the benefits that I've talked about here today. It doesn't have to be high-intensity exercise. The weekly volume that's recommended, 150 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity. And so you can see here the example I give. You can go walking 3 times per week for 50 minutes at a brisk pace, or you can go jogging 3 times per week for 25 minutes. So the equivalence is that you're getting roughly double the benefit from vigorous exercise as a rule of thumb. So if you want moderate exercise, try for 150 minutes per week. If you want vigorous, 75 minutes is good. Probably moderate intensity is more feasible during treatments. These are difficult times, and if you're feeling well enough, you can do more intense exercise. But for most patients, even moderate intensity exercise would be a challenge. And 2 days per week of strength training is recommended in addition to the aerobic exercise. The frequency, intensity, duration is not absolutely critical, although they do suggest that you spread it out over multiple days of the week, kind of a minimum of 3, and not try and get it all in 1 day. But to give you an example, to get 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, you can walk 3 times per week for 50 minutes, or you can walk 5 times per week for 30 minutes, or you can walk 6 times a week for 25 minutes. In other words, it doesn't really matter how you slice and dice it. It's trying to get to that total volume of exercise over the course of the week. So even durations as low as 10 minutes at a time can have health benefits. Moderate intensity, ideally, so this means some light sweating, some increased heart rate, breathing rate. It's not the casual exercise. So if you're whistling while you're walking your dog, you're probably not doing moderate intensity exercise. There should be some increase in heart rate, increase in breathing rate. And as I say, if someone saw you walking, they would think you're late for an appointment. So some pace to your step. Well, the last issue, which I won't spend any time on, just to sort of encourage you, exercise motivation. It is a challenge for all of us, and you can imagine it's even more of a challenge for cancer patients who are on difficult treatments. We've developed some motivational materials, and these are freely available on our website. This is a guidebook we've developed for breast cancer survivors, called Exercise for Health. And in it, it's really designed to motivate breast cancer survivors and give them guidelines to exercise, help them overcome the most common barriers to exercise, and motivate them with the beliefs and the benefits of exercise. So this is targeted uniquely to breast cancer survivors. We have other guidebooks we're working on that are targeted towards colon cancer survivors and also even young adult cancer survivors that we're testing and developing. But we've tested these materials in clinical trials and shown they help breast cancer survivors get more exercise. So you're welcome to go to our website and download this guidebook. So the final take-home message then is don't take cancer lying down. Thank you very much for your time.
Stay here. Good morning. My name is Hélène Perrault. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Education here at McGill, that faculty which houses the Department of Kinesiology. And I can't tell you how thrilled I am and what a pleasure it is to be here this morning to thank Dr. Cournier for that really excellent lecture. I mean, cancer does remain one of today's most pressing challenge because it is, of course, a disease that is one at once scientific, social, and personal, as was mentioned in the opening statements. I think your presentation here showed us that how much we have advanced the understanding of the factors that can impact the evolution of the disease and how we can use that knowledge to better design some treatment and management of the disease. I think that your presentation showed many important ideas, but in particular that the physical and mental strengths of many survivors can become the basis for more effective treatment. And that really you've given us some options, I think, some insight as to how really staying active and simple physical activity can be a powerful adjunct to the treatment. So, Carrie, thank you so very much for this very enlightening lecture. And I would like to thank you also for helping us to be celebrating our 100 years so appropriately this year. And it is the month of October, the month of breast cancer, so I think everything is aligning. Thank you so much. Now I would like to invite Professor Dilson Rassier. Professor Rassier is a professor in the Department of Kinesiology, and he is serving as the Associate Dean Research for our Faculty of Education. And Dilson, if you can come up. Dilson will be moderating the questions, taking some questions. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm not going to repeat the words of Dean Perrault. It was incredible and very motivational talk. Thank you, Dr. Cournier. We have time for some questions. We have the microphones on the right and left side of the theater, so if you have questions and you want to come up to the microphones, Dr. Cournier will be pleased to answer them. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the data show the benefits during treatment. I think the things we have to keep in mind is when we do these types of trials, oftentimes the patients that are coming forward for these trials are the ones that are healthier and feeling better at that time. And so these are the ones that do feel well enough and able enough to exercise during treatment. So we're a little reluctant to generalize back to all those other patients who said, oh, I'm very sick, I'm not doing well at all, and say, and put too much pressure to say you should exercise. So I think the data represent those patients who are well enough to do the exercise during treatment. And these treatments can be very difficult. I mean, we have some patients in this trial get the first dose of chemotherapy, and they're pretty well done in terms of quality of life, substantial nausea, substantial vomiting, and so on, and they're not able to do it. So we thought it's good, at least for those patients, to allow them to say, hey, if you can't do it during treatment, then let's try and get started as soon after treatment as possible.
Hi, Dr. Cornier. I enjoyed your talk again. And I had a question for you. Has there been anybody looking at whether the exercise itself might potentiate the responses to the chemotherapy? In other words, increase the rate at which the cancer goes into remission?
Yeah, very little. I think that data that I presented from our lymphoma trial, where we looked at treatment response, as far as I know, that's the only data that's really looked at this potentiation idea that if you're exercising during chemo, maybe the chemotherapy has higher efficacy at that time. So we haven't seen any other data looking at that issue, but I think it is absolutely one of the critical issues. So we want to follow up with these data and maybe design some larger trials to look at that issue.
Thanks again for your talk. Has there been any thought given as to why exercise is beneficial in terms of physiology or pathophysiology?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not the area that we focused on our research in terms of the mechanisms of how this might happen. There is a fair bit of animal research that's tried to look at some things like the effects on tumor growth and tumor progression and so on, but not a lot in humans that's tried to look at the mechanisms for why it might have this benefit. There are some epidemiological studies looking at things like insulin-like growth factors as really growth factors for cancer. In some of the breast cancer studies, they're looking at things like estrogen, because we know estrogen is a fuel for breast cancer, and some of the immune factors as well, inflammatory markers and those types of things. So there is some of that mechanistic research going on.
I have a question to the left.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. I just wanted to ask you, what is your experience in terms of alternative methods of exercise, like the Tai Chi, Qigong, all those techniques? I mean, how would you say those are in relation to more standard interventions?
Yeah, great question. Tai Chi, yoga, these things are very popular among cancer patients as kind of alternative ways of getting exercise. And there are some studies coming out now looking at these kind of controlled trials and those types of interventions. We haven't done any in our lab. But the general results of those studies is they seem to have very good benefits on the psychosocial outcomes, depression, anxiety, self-esteem, stress, and so on. Not quite as large on the physical benefits because they tend to be a bit more of a gentler type of exercise. So they can be very helpful for some of the psychosocial quality of life issues, very useful.
I found your talk extremely stimulating and very interesting. What I was curious about is that there was no breakdown in terms of the ages of the people participating. And I wondered whether there was any kind of measurable difference between younger patients who begin the 60-minute vigorous exercise program and those who are older, and do you have fewer participants, say, in the over 60 group?
Yeah, a great question. So in these trials, we take any age coming in. The mean age in these studies for the breast cancer studies is usually about early 50s, but it varies dramatically. We know that breast cancer is diagnosed in women in their 20s, and we have some women in their 20s in those trials, and we have women all the way up well into their 70s and even early 80s in the trial. So it is quite diverse. In this CARE trial, we've not yet checked the data by the different age categories, but we will absolutely look at that because we've done that in previous trials. So in the START trial, we did break them down into under and over 50 because about half were under 50, half were over 50. And we didn't find any differences there in how they responded. We didn't find any differences in terms of their adherence to the exercise program or the benefits that they had. But I think you might be onto something with this higher volume of exercise, the 60 minutes, and so we'll be quite interested to look at any age differences and whether it's more beneficial for the younger patients or the older patients. So we look forward to looking at those data. Thank you.
Yep. Hi, I'm Miguel, physical education graduate, so I don't need the microphone.
Okay, coach. Yes, and that research has been around much longer than this research. So we've looked at exercise as a risk factor, as the epidemiologists call it, for developing cancer in the first place. And hundreds of studies on that topic. Very good data to show if you exercise as a young adult over the course of your life, you have a lower risk of developing breast cancer. Epidemiologists call that evidence convincing, no doubt. And same for colon cancer. People who exercise over the course of their lifetime have a 50% lower risk of developing colon cancer. And even potential some of the other cancers, endometrial cancer, and oddly enough, even lung cancer. Studies showing people who exercise are at lower risk of developing lung cancer. And some data on prostate cancer and so on. So I think there's very good evidence for prevention of cancer with breast and colon, and some good evidence for some of these other cancers like prostate, lung, and so on. So you really can reduce your risk of developing these most common cancers with exercise.
We'll take three more questions. We have one here in the right, two in the left, please.
We are sorry we missed your talk because of coincidence that we changed the hall, so we've been looking around and around. So sorry about that. We're very interested about the contents of your conference. It looks like the reaction is very positive. We are very specifically interested in myeloma application cancer. Is there any chance we could get a copy of your presentation somehow?
I'm more than happy to make it available, yeah. Okay, great. They're saying that it will be posted online.
Posted online?
Yes.
Great. So can I contact you in a few minutes? Yes. Thank you very much.
So we have two more questions, please, one in the right, one in the left. And then after this period of questions, Dr. Cornu will be happy to talk to you in private with any other questions that you may have.
Okay. You mentioned the uncertainty around why patients who exercise vigorously feel less fatigued. Do you have any hypothesis about why that might be? For instance, if they have an elevated heart rate, if it's a tolerance thing, why would people feel less fatigued in the long run, even if they're doing a lot of heavy exercise?
Yeah, I think it is improvements in exercise capacity. I didn't present the data here, but we actually look at what we call a statistical mediation between aerobic fitness and improvements in fatigue. And what we see is the patients that are telling us they have the best reductions in the fatigue are the ones who have the biggest increases in aerobic fitness. So you can think about doing activities of daily living. The more capacity you have to take the stairs and do all these types of things, the less fatiguing it is to live your daily life. So we think it is due to these objective improvements in the cardiovascular system and how that allows you to engage in life and not feel fatigued at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more question, please. We're going to make this the last question so that we give Dr. Cornelius some time as well to not get fatigued with all these talks that he's giving for us. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. I'm just wondering how somebody, either a cancer survivor, somebody who is currently undergoing treatments, who's had no experience with exercise previously, how do they embark on finding somebody to actually give them the proper kind of program? Because there's so many types of trainers out there.
Yeah.
And the worry would be that, you know, you're not getting the right kind of prescription.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And again, with our survey data that we've done with various cancer patient groups, they all tell us they would like help about exercise from someone who knows both about exercise and cancer, someone who understands the cancer treatments and the exercise principles. And we've been working on that. So the American College of Sports Medicine now has a cancer exercise specialist degree. So these are exercise trainers who take additional training in cancer and become experts specialized in the working with cancer patients and survivors. I'm not sure how many of them are out there right now, because this is a very new certification that's been developed. We're also finding in some places around Canada and in the U.S., YMCAs are now offering exercise programs for cancer survivors and developing expertise in that area. But I also believe there is some programs right here in Montreal. There's the Hope and Cope program that has a wellness center where they have people who have expertise in exercise and cancer. And also I think the Cancer Rehabilitation and Nutrition Group at McGill University as well. So you've got some local expertise in this area that you might be able to get a hold of to help you out with that.
Well, I would like to thank again Dr. Gournier for this very interesting talk. I guess most people are fascinated by this new field of research, and I'm sure if you have more questions, if you have comments, Dr. Gournier will be helped to talk to you after this meeting. So I'll thank you very much. I'm now going to pass the podium. And thank you very much, Dr. Gournier.
Hello, my name is Alan Denoyer. I'm the Vice President of the McGill Alumni Association. It's my privilege this morning to thank our 2012 Beattie Memorial Lecture for yet another fascinating talk. Your presentation was certainly drew a lot of interest. You're bringing to the attention some of the local resources that are there, I think is encouraging as well. Please accept on behalf of the Alumni Association this gift. I'd like to say thank you to, first of all, the Beattie Memorial Lecture Committee for organizing yet another fantastic event. Also, for the Homecoming Committee for their continued support and sponsorship. Through lectures such as this one, we keep alive the spirit of free inquiry and research excellence that is the heart of McGill's mission. Finally, thank you to all of you for attending. I hope that everyone enjoys the rest of Homecoming. I encourage you to take advantage of the remaining activities, including a full slate of classes without quizzes, today's big football game, tours of the campus and the new MUHC Glen Yard site, a number of events related to the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education's centennial celebrations. I encourage you to walk briskly as you go from one event to the other. Merci encore une fois et je vous souhaite une bonne fin de semaine.